It's Friday, January 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry prepares for talks on Syria's future. Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders seems to be gaining popularity against former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
Bernie Sanders, not only is he not going away, he seems to be on a mini surge in Iowa, where Clinton has had a lead for a long time. And for a long time now, Bernie Sanders has had a lead in the second state that'll vote, New Hampshire.
And we'll revisit the capture of a notorious Mexican drug lord. It's all ahead. Before holding talks in Saudi Arabia Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is taking part in the 2016 World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. It follows his talks in Zurich Wednesday with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, about political transition talks in Syria. Those talks, scheduled to get underway Monday in Geneva, appear to be in jeopardy over the lack of consensus on who should represent the opposition. Mr. Lavrov, however, said he has no thoughts about moving the date back into next month. He expressed confidence the talks will get underway in January. U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner said the momentum in the peace process needs to continue.
Our expectation is that the talks will take place on January 25th. Those are UN-led talks. It's really for the parties involved to reach agreement on who will participate in those talks, but we still want to see them take place on January 25th. Clearly, that's the date we're still looking toward. We believe that the talks need to happen on schedule. And again, for a lot of obvious reasons, we want to keep momentum going. Once these talks take place, that obviously sets in place a timetable for an ultimate political resolution to the conflict. So these things matter. These dates matter. So we want to see every effort made to adhere to them.
But speaking Wednesday to the cable news network, UN Syria envoy Stefan de Mistura said invitation to the talks have not yet gone out, and he may not be able to say they have until Sunday. University of Denver professor and regional analyst Jonathan Adelman tells International Edition's Victor Beatty it's going to be difficult to meet Monday's deadline.
And I think the Russians are playing a clever game. I actually met Lavrov twice before he was foreign minister. He's a very smart guy. He almost functions like a computer. And so he's thinking, let's not give him another few days that maybe they might come up with something more acceptable. Because deep down, they really don't want to do most of this. So they want to just cram the UN and the pro-Western people into a bind, because there's many opposition groups, and the Russians no doubt have them all raided. And so the less time there is to resolve it, the less likely it's going to be resolved. And let's not forget that at the end of the day, they want to either keep Bashar Assad in power or one of his cronies, which is where they might actually go. The less that can be done to harm them, the better off they are. And, you know, their attacks have been fairly successful in going after some of the opposition groups.
Well, what is their game aside from supporting Mr. Assad?
Their game is that this is being looked at from their point of view, not just by Syrians, but it's being looked at all over the world, that Egyptians are looking at it, with whom they have the $2 billion, you know, military deal, and they're wondering how serious the Russians are about this effort to get back in the Middle East. Because we all know that the Egyptians, for example, kicked them out almost 40 years ago, and that was true of several other countries as well. So the way they handle themselves is not just a Russian question. It's also an effort to give the impression that we are tough, we're ready to rumble, and if you, and I'm now talking about non-Syrians, you know, want a country you can rely on, unlike in their view the United States, we're going to be there with you down the line.
The Associated Press has an interesting story about the Russian military presence in Syria, saying that they've conducted in just a few short months some 5,700 missions. And according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, Russian strikes are directly responsible for killing more than 1,000 civilians, including more than 200 children. With this horrific cost of these airstrikes, what are they accomplishing?
From their point of view, they're showing that they're willing to do whatever is necessary to keep the Assad regime, and I'd like to emphasize, it doesn't necessarily mean Bashar Assad, but somebody associated with him, in power. And when you look around the Middle East today, for many countries, like El-Sisi in Egypt, for example. They're very nervous about what could be happening to them. So the Russians are showing them, look, we will do what we say. We will intervene. And if we have to kill a few thousand people, we're going to kill a few thousand people because they're supporting hostile elements.
That is Jonathan Edelman of the University of Denver. The Russian foreign minister also said he spoke with Kerry about how the Russian Air Force and planning its operations can more closely cooperate with the U.S.-led coalition in taking into account UN, NGO, and Red Cross humanitarian efforts in Syria. Well, now for a look at social media, the Associated Press reports that Secretary of State John Kerry says initial Syria peace talks in Geneva will not be face-to-face. The Guardian reports the talks will be delayed by a couple of days, but are supposed to occur next week. And Secretary Kerry tells the Davos meeting that Syria is the largest humanitarian disaster of our times. In other news, two former Burundian presidents have appealed to the UN Security Council to press the current government to accept an African Union-led peacekeeping force. Former presidents Domitien Ndizeye and Jean-Baptiste Bagaza met Thursday with a council delegation, which is on a quick visit to Bujumbura to try to stem the political violence that has killed at least 439 people since April. Burundi's president, Pierre Nkurunziza, is firmly opposed to a peacekeeping force. The council arrived in Burundi's capital late Thursday on its second visit in less than a year. VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir is traveling with the council delegation, and I spoke with her. What is the UN team looking to there?
The Security Council is on its second day visiting Burundi today, and they've had a whole series of meetings so far today with members of civil society, from the opposition, from the government, religious leaders, political party leaders, and I think they heard a whole array of messages, but really, in a way, nothing new, because as you would expect, the opposition is telling you that things are very bad here, and the government is telling you that there's not a problem. So I think a lot of what they heard today, they've heard before, but they're here on the ground and they're feeling out people on a number of subjects, including on getting the country to move towards dialogue. I think that's really one of the big messages that the Security Council is here to deliver, that they want to press the parties to have a full and a real peace, to respect the Arusha Accords that ended this country's previous conflict. And they are really meeting all levels of society to try and convey that message and to hear from them.
Now, I believe the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., Samantha Power, is she on this trip?
Yes, she's one of the co-leaders along with the ambassador of Angola and the French deputy ambassador. And so they have been conducting these meetings together, and the council is going to go to Gatanga province today to meet with President Pierre Nkurunziza. That's their next meeting on this Friday here in Burundi.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Margaret. That's VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir in Bujumbura, Burundi. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Scientists say that Earth was once like a giant snowball and coated with a thick layer of ice about 640 to 720 million years ago. Many think that this period of heavy glaciation was due to a change in the ocean's chemistry and a significant drop in atmospheric carbon dioxide levels brought on by the breakup of the supercontinent known as Rodinia. New research indicates that as ice coated the Earth's surface, volcanoes were violently erupting under the surface of the planet's oceans. Researchers say that carbon dioxide produced by these underwater volcanoes eventually made its way into the atmosphere, which warmed it enough to melt the thick ice that covered the planet. A buildup of material from these volcanoes also helped change ocean chemistry that released large amounts of calcium, magnesium, and phosphorus. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we look at the recapture of El Chapo. A authorities in Pakistan have announced that after 3 years of completely blocking the video sharing site YouTube, they're lifting the ban and will now allow Pakistanis to access the site. However, there's already disagreement between Pakistani telecommunications officials and Google, the owner of YouTube, as to just what that might mean and who will have control of videos posted there. International Edition's Doug Bernard joins us. Well, Doug, first, why was YouTube blocked in the first place?
Hi, Sarah. Well, I think everybody knows, but just to make sure. So YouTube is a video sharing site. You can upload videos of all kinds, of all lengths to the site, as long as you have the copyright. And there are billions and billions of hours of video on the site. So managing it is really a superhuman task. Now, back in 2012, there was a trailer released for a movie, although we don't know if the movie ever actually was going to happen, called The Innocence of Muslims. And there was content in that movie that many Muslims around the world found very offensive. There were riots in many places. In Pakistan, for example, actually 14 people were killed in protests regarding this movie that may or may not have ever been. So the Pakistani officials had decided they had enough. They'd had a kind of hate-hate relationship with YouTube to begin with, because there's all kinds of material up there. And so they just decided that's it, and they put an entire block or a ban on the site.
So what is this going to mean now? What will Pakistanis be able to view?
Well, you would think that they would be able to view anything that is on YouTube that you or I could watch from the United States or wherever. Now, the Pakistani authorities, the PTA, the Pakistani Telecommunications Authority, says they've worked out an agreement with Google such that any video that they personally, that the ministry finds offensive, they have an expedited process. They just sort of send Google a note, and Google will take down that video. However, Google, which owns YouTube, says that no such agreement of any kind exists. So, you know, less than 24 hours after the ban or the block was lifted, there was clearly disagreement as to what it exactly meant. But it seems clear that Pakistani officials really do want to try and maintain some control over what gets up there, and that, in many ways, I think, kind of runs counter to YouTube and Google's corporate culture.
Because this could lead to a situation where it's really not that different than it was before, really, if the government wants to block.
That's exactly right. And, of course, the block was irritating and I'm sure prevented many millions of people from getting to it. Although those clever enough, there are many ways, as you know, in the Internet, there are many ways around these kinds of things. It just takes persistence and maybe some, you know, training and skill, that kind of thing. So it was effective at some level, but the people who were clever enough who wanted to get the videos could get them, record them, and spread them around themselves if they wanted. So, yes, we may be back in a position, and I think this will be a position that we're going to continue to see in Pakistan and many other countries. Countries want a certain degree of control over what gets put on social media, and the social media companies generally, you know, hold up the banner of free expression and free speech, and so those two forces are very often, you know, in colliding with one another.
All right. Thanks very much. That's International Edition's Doug Bernard.
Thank you.
Voters will finally weigh in on the U.S. presidential race in just under 2 weeks when the Iowa caucuses select early favorites. Among the Democrats, Bernie Sanders has made an amazing surge in the polls over Hillary Clinton. VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone joined International Edition's Jim Stevenson to elaborate on this development.
We've focused so much over the past 6 months or so on the rise of Donald Trump in the Republican race. In a way, that's overshadowed what's going on in the Democratic race. And a lot of people may be now readjusting their predictions because Bernie Sanders, not only is he not going away, he seems to be on a mini surge in Iowa, where Clinton has had a lead for a long time. And for a long time now, Bernie Sanders has had a lead in the second state that'll vote, New Hampshire, which holds its primary on February 9th. So a 1-2 punch of Sanders defeating Clinton in both Iowa and New Hampshire certainly would reset the race. It might not make Sanders the favorite for the nomination. Clinton would still seem to be a strong contender. She still has great strengths with minority voters, which are a really important part of the Democratic Party. But we see of late Bernie Sanders trying to fix that a bit by reaching out to African-American and other minorities to try to bolster his support there. But, yeah, you know, on one hand, the Trump phenomenon on the Republican side and the Sanders phenomenon on the Democratic side, unorthodox candidates, outsiders, it seems to be the rage for both parties this year.
What are some of the issues that Bernie Sanders is bringing up that are resonating with voters?
Well, you know, he has from the beginning focused on this sort of inequality argument that too much wealth in America is concentrated in too few people, the billionaire class, he likes to call them. I think there's some studies that shows there's several hundred, 500 billionaires in the country. So that's a pretty small group. But this argument that Sanders has been making, that there's been too much concentration of wealth, seems to be having an impact. And, you know, a lot of the candidates are trying to appeal to the broader middle class. And whether it's an economic argument that we've heard from Sanders, or in the case of Trump, it might be more of a grievance argument, that it's time to settle some old scores and people are angry and upset. Both of these things seem to be reaching voters right now. And I think all the other candidates are taking note. In the case of Hillary Clinton, she's very well known. She offers an experienced candidate. I think they're just a little taken aback at how resilient Sanders has proven. They have their work cut out for them.
That is VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support of Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition. The Mexican government's dramatic recapture of drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman earlier this month is shining a new spotlight on its handling of the war on illegal narcotics. Rolling Stone magazine's new report that El Chapo met secretly with Hollywood actor Sean Penn and Mexican TV star Kate Del Castillo while on the run last October has fueled social media interest in the issue even more. The El Chapo saga was the topic of this week's hashtag VOA TV program, and host Michael Lippin joins us to share a highlight from the show.
This week we looked at how social media have responded to El Chapo's recapture and his interview with Sean Penn for Rolling Stone magazine. We had two guests joining us via Skype. From Phoenix, Arizona, we had journalism professor Angela Corcherga. And from Mexico City, we had investigative journalist John Ackerman. Now, during the show, I asked Ackerman whether we learned anything new from Penn's story.
I think Sean Penn's article is very important, particularly because it points to government complicity and the complicity of international corporations with this international business of death and drugs. Sean Penn's very clear about the complicity of the Mexican military with the Chapo Guzman, and also mentions direct statements from Chapo Guzman in which he talks about important multinational corporations who do money laundering for him. This is not new information, of course, but one of the reasons why so much attention has been put on Sean Penn and Kate Del Castillo is actually an explicit strategy by the Mexican government. The Mexican government announces that they captured him, by the way, on Friday. Only once the article comes out, which is the day after, it's just Saturday, the capture was on Friday, the article came out on Saturday, and then on Sunday, the Mexican government then starts to push this story that somehow Sean Penn and Kate Del Castillo are the responsible ones to deflect attention precisely, which should be on the Mexican government, on U.S. drug users and the United States government, towards this issue of Hollywood stars. During the following days, they illegally let out messages that had been exchanged between Kate Del Castillo and El Chapo's lawyer to sort of feed this media frenzy. And yes, I would agree there with Sean Penn when he said that in some ways his article has failed because the attention's all on him and Kate Del Castillo, when actually that article and the issues it talks about should lead to serious soul-searching, both in the United States and Mexico.
Angela Corcherga in Phoenix, John was talking about all the corruption issues that are raised with this article, but what about all the violence perpetrated by the cartel, by El Chapo's cartel? That wasn't really covered much in Sean Penn's piece. Do people have a sense that he failed partly in that aspect as well?
Well, he's sad about the state of journalism, but he didn't seem very sad about the countless bodies, the body count that we've seen because of the drug war. Obviously not just the Sinaloa cartel. You know, Chapo says that he only goes after rivals who challenge him. But, you know, having covered in what is multiple mass murders, and I don't want to get too graphic, with just blood running through the streets, it's very difficult to see how he could just say, well, he's a poor farmer who was forced into the drug business, and it's all blamed on U.S. consumption, which is a very, very serious problem. We're not going to downplay that part. But, you know, I've gone to neighborhoods in Juarez after a massacre at a rehab center where young people who were trying to get off of drugs were there trying it as best they could. They were attacked because they had been part of the drug trade. I interviewed a young boy who lost his brother in that massacre, and just a year before I'd lost another brother. And his mother was sobbing inside the house. I mean, there was a real toll. That neighborhood, every single child I talked to in that neighborhood had experienced violence, had lost a parent, had lost a friend, had lost a relative. I went back to check on that young boy. There were no more young boys in that neighborhood. They had either fled or been killed because of this street-level drug violence in Juarez. So there is a real toll, and none of that was touched upon in the article.
Well, if you'd like to hear more of that conversation on the El Chapo saga, just go to our Facebook page, which is called #VOA.
My thanks to Michael Lippin for that report. That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Democracy is critical to Africa's future. But if democracy is to take root and flourish, specific conditions must be met. Chief among these are free and fair elections. These, in turn, cannot take place if the voting public lacks access to information about important issues, or if voters are prevented from meeting with or rallying for their chosen candidates. In other words, freedom of speech and of the press and freedom of association are indispensable aspects of free elections and of democracy itself. That is why the United States is concerned about the deteriorating electoral environment in Uganda and the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections set to be held on February 18th. 8 candidates are vying for the presidency, including sitting president Yoweri Museveni, who first came to power in 1986 but was only elected into office in 1996. He is currently running for a 5th term in office. According to Human Rights Watch, Uganda's current election campaign is fraught with intimidation of journalists, including threats or warnings of possible repercussions for critical reporting, government harassment and intimidation of independent voices in the media and civil society, obstruction and dispersal by police of opposition rallies with excessive illegal arrests, beatings, and other use of force by security personnel. At least one member of a candidate's staff, opposition campaign aide Christopher Aine, has disappeared. For the sake of Uganda and all of its people, the upcoming elections must be free, fair, and transparent. The United States believes that for this to happen, all Ugandans must have the opportunity to exercise their right to assemble peacefully, express their opinions, and participate in the electoral process free from intimidation and abuse. They also depend on government institutions and security forces remaining neutral, defending the rights of all people and protecting all parties equally, wrote State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a statement. We call on the government, civil society, and political parties to do their part to ensure a peaceful, transparent, and credible electoral process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.